Mr. Montag is going to join us by WebEx, I believe. Mr. Montag, are you with us on WebEx this morning?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Started, Judge Masteller has just entered the courtroom, and I earlier told him that he should sit where Justice Frydenberg normally does. He can actually move into Justice Funk's chair if he wishes.
This one's great, Chief.
Very good. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Montag, I'm not going to go through introductions from the court, but you should note that Justice Miller Lerman is also on WebEx, as you are. So you may get questioning not only from the bench here, but also from the WebEx screen. With that in mind, Mr. Montag, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brad Montag. I'm the attorney for Rosario Betancourt Garcia. This is an appeal from Mr. Garcia's petition for post-conviction relief filed in the district court in Madison County. With that petition, the court granted an evidentiary hearing on three of his claims and denied the balance of the claims. This appeal is for the balance of the claims that were denied that Mr. Betancourt wished to appeal. That's what we're here for. There's a lot of claims. I guess I just am going to try to talk about a couple of them. The balance of the claims that he wanted presented, I would just submit as they were argued in the brief. The first issue, I guess, is the destroyed evidence, the tape. The evidence at trial was that Mr. Betancourt had bound the victim with duct tape about the wrists, ankles, and in the mouth. I think the evidence was indicated that Mr. Betancourt alone did that. The tape was removed from the victim by the officer or a citizen, I guess, that was on the scene, and the officer was there present. The officer, following procedure, marked and bagged the tape, put it in evidence bags, and preserved it at the scene. Those bags were then taken to the evidence room, and they were stored there for several years. At trial, at least as far as I could tell, at trial, the first indication of anything happening to that tape came out there in the officer's testimony and cross-examination. The officer indicated that the tape was gone and the state no longer had possession of that evidence. The trial counsel did not raise any issue with it, did not file a motion for a hearing to determine what had happened with it. Appellate counsel did not do anything with that either, did not address it as insufficient counsel. To me, I guess it's obvious that whoever would have bound that victim with the duct tape would likely leave some DNA evidence on that tape, which in this case, I think is materially exculpatory. At the trial, the prosecutor showed pictures of the victim when the tape had been removed from his ankles, his wrist, and his face. And it's noted in the record that, you know, you can see the skin missing, the hair missing, and such, which I think clearly indicates that somebody touching the backside of that tape is going to likely leave DNA evidence. And again, it was never objected to or raised by trial counsel, nor any issues raised by appellate counsel.
Your client, Mr. Montag, I believe absconded, did he not?
Yes, he was, they didn't locate him for some time. That's correct. I think they sent him down to, or he's arrested in Texas, and then he was deported to Mexico.
So he wasn't rearrested for, as I think you've already noted, several years, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Does that fact have any relevance to your argument today? And I guess what I'm asking is, did your client contribute to the fact that the state ultimately loses this evidence at some point in time?
I don't think my client had anything to do with the evidence being lost. The evidence was there, it was preserved. And
it was preserved for a period of time, but when the evidence was available, your client wasn't available. I guess I will ask again, is that relevant at all to this court's consideration of your argument?
I don't think on this argument that's relevant, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about one of your allegations of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, to which the state has responded by suggesting a plain error analysis rather than an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis. I understand in the post-conviction where we would be with the ineffective assistance of counsel analysis, but I'm having difficulty identifying what the constitutional right that would be claimed that it was violated of your client by the sentence to life without parole. I realize that life without parole would have been erroneous. On direct appeal, it would have been plain error. On post-conviction, I'm just wondering if you believe that there is some right other than the ineffective assistance of counsel route that leads to the same result. And if so, what right is it?
I guess I don't have an answer to that, Judge. I think that it seems to me, and I can't recall the case, but it seems to me that a defendant is entitled to be properly sentenced. And in this case, I think it was an improper sentence. Realistically, I don't know that it makes a huge difference, but I guess I don't have a great answer for you on it.
I beg your pardon. Assuming there is an error, and you all have briefed it and so forth, and the state seems to have acknowledged it, if it were successful, would the remedy then be have a hearing on the appropriateness of that sentence?
Yeah, I think.
And we may already know the answer, but it would not necessarily be for this court to vacate the sentence.
I think that it should, if I understand what you're asking, I think that it should be remanded for resentencing on that issue. With regard to the lost or destroyed evidence, at the DNA hearing, more evidence comes out regarding what happened with regard to the tape. Essentially, evidence is that the officer testified that the mayor of Madison at the time directed that he clean out the evidence room. There was no order. I don't know why the mayor is deciding what happens with that, but there was no order given by anybody. The mayor just told him to clean it out. The officer took it upon himself to burn the evidence. I just think that the handling of the evidence was so egregious that even if it's not materially exculpatory, it's in bad faith.
I beg your pardon. So the Youngblood case you are familiar with from the U.S. Supreme Court seems to suggest that in a matter such as yours, where you're asserting this is a due process, i.e. a constitutional defect, that the bad faith of the individuals who maintain the evidence is relevant. Is there evidence of bad faith destroying the evidence?
Your Honor, I think that the method and the procedure and the manner with which it was destroyed rises to the level of being in bad faith. And I think it was so egregious that at least there should have been a hearing so that a court could determine whether or not bad faith, there was any bad faith there. No one ordered it destroyed. The officer just destroyed it. He never consulted with the prosecutor. Asking, do we need this? Is it something that we should try to preserve or maintain? He never tries to just, it's two small baggies of evidence. Doesn't try to put them in another location or transfer the evidence from the evidence room. He never tries to do that, never questions. And, you know, this is a kidnapping case with a potential life sentence. It's not like it was an MIP when there was a six pack of beer and you're looking at a 30 day or a fine for some kid. I just think that, and it wasn't housekeeping. Nobody told him to destroy it. Housekeeping would have been maybe move it somewhere else or put it in a smaller corner of the room or talk to the county attorney, decide what to do with it. And I just think that the trouble with these is that sometimes you don't know what's there until you're able to test it. And I understand that the law says you got to show some bad faith if it's only potentially exculpatory. But I think I think it was so egregious that there should have been at least a hearing to determine it, because, you know, it really could have made a difference if there's any DNA evidence on that tape. I mean, his defense was the alibi defense, and I think that could have helped support his argument there. Now, we do have an evidentiary hearing on those issues coming, but I think it would help support that defense. So with that, I'm out of time. I would just submit it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Let's grab some water here. May it please the court, my name is Austin Rolf. I represent the state of Nebraska. The overarching issue is whether the district court properly denied Betancourt's remaining claims of post-conviction or for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. I set forth in my brief, and I'll address in more detail here shortly. We think the district court's order was correct, with one exception, Your Honor referenced, that being the sentence for conspiracy. He was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, which is not a valid sentence in Nebraska. And so we asked this court to vacate and remand for resentencing with direction to impose a sentence of life imprisonment. I kind of struggled as well, Your Honor, as to the proper remedy on that claim. Obviously, there's error. This court has said, State v. Thorpe, cases before, that life imprisonment without parole is not a valid sentence in Nebraska. And it kind of surprised me to find in my research cases where this court had done it through a plain error prism, they had vacated sentences and remanded for resentencing or imposed sentences. So
when I looked at the cases that you cited in your brief, and I'll confess I didn't attempt to go beyond those two, and I highly respect the judges. But wrote those opinions. But let's stop.
It's bad timing.
May I have your attention, please? There is a recorded in the middle. Please proceed to the stairway.
Let us just wait for a moment.
Sure.
May I have your attention, please?
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. For those of you on WebEx, we've got a fire alarm going off. These are normally not because there is a fire. False alarm, Mr. Ralph, you may proceed.
I think I was in the middle of the sentence.
Yeah.
Where I said I could not discern from either of the opinions the constitutional right that was, that made the judgments void or voidable. Can you tell me? Can you educate me on that?
No, I think they just did it. I think through the constitutional right would be the ineffective assistance of counsel, which would then require an evidentiary hearing and then findings by the district court. I think those justices, those courts in those cases just short-circuited that a little bit and did it themselves. So I don't have a good answer for you. I don't think we're getting into like the nebulous, you know, fundamental fairness, due process, anything like that. I think if you're looking for the constitutional basis, it would just be ineffective assistance, which would require a hearing.
So even though you've asked us to vacate, maybe the more appropriate path is to send it back for an evidentiary hearing with a strong hint.
Yes. And if this court, you know, obviously with the three claims that were granted an evidentiary hearing, one of them was also a sentencing issue. And the district court, I think, appropriately said, okay, we're going to grant an evidentiary hearing. It might be academic, but we will fix it through the prism of ineffective assistance. That would be also perhaps the most appropriate way to do it.
I beg your pardon. Just to clarify, there are a couple of sentencing errors or alleged errors all in play, correct? So the hearing that was ordered, is this correct, was with respect to count two on the use, and the trial judge said, I'll hold a hearing because a mandatory five appears to be an erroneous sentence. That one has been sent back for hearing. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And so then pardon me. Go ahead, please.
No, the two other claims were related to alibi defenses, and the district court basically said, you know, I'm not sure that anything will come of this. I probably don't think there will be, but in light of this court's recent decision in, the name is blanking on me right now, but one of the recent decisions that had, you know, basically indicated an evidentiary hearing was appropriate. He sent those two claims plus the sentencing claim for an evidentiary hearing, denied the balance.
I beg your pardon. So what we're discussing then, that's count two on the use. That is already going back for a hearing. And what's on deck for this conversation is count three, the conspiracy, where the sentence was life without parole, which all the world seems to think is not a thing.
Correct. Yes. In basically the other claims, my plan was to address the ones that he addressed today, and then submit the rest on the brief. So regarding the destroyed evidence, I think the framework is pretty clear. If it's materially exculpatory evidence, bad faith would be irrelevant to the destruction. But here, it's not materially exculpatory. It would fall in the category of, at best, potentially exculpatory. And I say at best because I don't know that the absence of his DNA on the binding tape or the shoelaces or whatnot would make a lick of difference, considering it's his nephew and his co-conspirator identifying him as the offender. An absence of DNA really isn't that probative. But in any event, it would be at best potentially exculpatory, which would require bad faith. And I think based on the record, it's pretty clear there was not bad faith. He had absconded, as Your Honor noted, it had been 7 years. And basically it was a housekeeping matter. Now it might've been negligent on the part of the officer, but certainly not to the level of bad faith. And so any claim there would necessarily fail. And so we think the delayed and ineffective claim did not warrant an evidentiary hearing on that ground. Unless this court has further questions, like I said, I would stick to my plan and submit the rest of the brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Thank you very much, Mr. Montag. Thank you for appearing by WebEx. And Mr. Ralph, thank you for appearing in person. Council, you are excused, and this is the last case of the day for the court. So the court is adjourned. Everybody's excused.
Thank you. Thank you.